From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of the feminist underground network that helped 11,000 women get abortions in the 4 years before abortion was legalized. The group used the code name Jane. Jane started as a referral service, but later the women in the group learned to do the abortions themselves. We'll talk with Laura Kaplan, a member of Jane, who has written a new book about it. Also, we check in with rock composer, instrumentalist, and producer Ben Vaughn. Since relocating from New Jersey to L.A. 1 year ago, he's composed music for films and TV. He wrote the theme for the sitcom which premieres tonight on NBC, Third Rock from the Sun. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. People in the eastern U.S. have been trying to dig out from one of the worst snowstorms there in decades, but their efforts have been hampered by more snow that's falling today. 80 deaths have been attributed to the storm. Jim Krasula reports that National Guard troops have been called out to help out some people in North Carolina.
As people all across central and western North Carolina continue digging out from the blizzard of 96, dozens of National Guard troops have been brought in to help clear snow and provide transportation for essential work personnel like doctors and nurses and police, fire, and rescue workers. With many roads still snow-covered and hazardous, it may be Thursday before most schools and businesses reopen across the western half of the state. Several emergency shelters are open for people whose homes have been left without power and heat. Jim Krasula, Greensboro, North Carolina.
A school bus crashed into a tractor-trailer this morning in Green Bay, Wisconsin. The bus driver was killed and over three dozen schoolchildren were injured. Police say the bus either failed to yield or neglected to stop for a stop sign. They also say slippery road conditions from new fallen snow could have been a factor. A federal appeals court in St. Louis has ruled that a sexual harassment case filed against President Clinton by a former Arkansas State employee can go to trial. From St. Louis, Melissa Jaco reports.
The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled by a 2-1 margin that the sexual harassment case against President Clinton can proceed while he's in office. The lawsuit, filed in 1994 by former Arkansas State employee Paula Jones, alleges Mr. Clinton made unwanted sexual advances toward her when he was governor of that state. The president has denied such an encounter took place, and his lawyers sought to dismiss the case on grounds of presidential immunity. The lawsuit seeks more than $700,000 in damages. The ruling is expected to be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Jaco in St. Louis.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher has departed Andrews Air Force Base en route to the Middle East. His first stop is Jerusalem as he undertakes shuttle diplomacy designed to build on the Israeli-Syrian peace talks held in the U.S. over the last few weeks. Barry Schwide reports.
Well, this is Christopher's 15th negotiating trip to the Middle East. He has made peace between Israel and Syria his number one foreign policy priority for 1996. And by all indications, he has quite a bit to go. This is likely to be a very short trip. The two sides aren't at the point where they can, where they're close to a peace treaty, and a point at which the Secretary of State presumably can finish off the final nagging details.
Barry Schwide reporting from Andrews Air Force Base. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 39.5 points in heavy trading of 333 million shares. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite Index is down 23.5 points. This is NPR News. A rocket-propelled grenade hit a streetcar in Sarajevo today, killing one person and wounding at least two others. The attack occurred on a street called Sniper's Alley, where snipers killed dozens of people during the Bosnian War. The International Committee of the Red Cross says the Bosnian government army is blocking the planned release next week of the last 900 prisoners from the war. The Red Cross says the Bosnian army has put conditions on the release. The White House says President Clinton will travel to Bosnia this weekend to visit U.S. troops taking part in the NATO peacekeeping mission. There is record unemployment in Germany, according to December figures from the labor office there, the German economy the largest in Europe. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Nearly 10% of the German workforce was jobless in December. Government and union officials expressed concern about the jump from 9.2% in November to 9.9% in December. The director of the German Labor Office, Bernhard Jagoda, attributed the sharp rise in part to unusually cold winter weather, but he admitted unemployment in 1995 was more severe than expected. Jagoda said it is unlikely unemployment will be reduced much this year. Another sharp rise is expected in January. Union officials have offered wide-scale concessions in the next round of labor negotiations in exchange for new jobs. But German business leaders have so far rejected the offer as unrealistic. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
An ambulance plane flying a critically ill patient to a hospital crashed last night in a thick fog near the Spokane, Washington airport. Three of the four people aboard were killed. The plane plowed into a warehouse. An adventurer trying to become the first person to circle the Earth in a balloon has passed over the Atlantic coast on a course that will take him towards Spain. But Steve Fawcett has been battling extreme cold, a balky autopilot, and problems with the heater that warms his pilot capsule. Ground crew members say the temperature in the capsule is probably around 0 degrees. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the 4 years before abortion was legalized in 1973, about 11,000 women got abortions through an underground feminist group in Chicago. The members of the group used the code name Jane in all of their phone calls and correspondence. And although the group was officially known as the Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation, it too became known simply as Jane. Jane started as an abortion referral service, helping women find alternatives to back alley butchers. But eventually, members of Jane learned to do the procedure themselves, believing that was the best way they could control the quality of abortion while it was illegal. My guest Laura Kaplan worked with Jane during the last year and a half of its existence. She's written a new book called The Story of Jane. I asked her why the founders wanted to create an underground abortion network.
I think women felt they had to more than that they wanted to. That at that point, pre-Roe v. Wade, so many women were seeking illegal abortions, and at that point they were really on their own. So there was no quality check. There was no way they knew when they contacted somebody a name they'd gotten from a friend or a neighbor or even through their doctor, whether that person was competent, what would happen to them, even how much actually it would cost. There were women had experiences where they went expecting to pay a certain amount of money, and when they got there, they were told, no, it was quite a bit more money. So there were financial questions around financial exploitation, and primarily there were questions around physical exploitation and sexual exploitation. It was rather common for illegal abortionists to demand sexual favors before an abortion, so that women's liberation groups around the country felt that one way they could help women was to monitor the illegal underground system so that they could assure women of good treatment.
It's a horrifying thought, the idea of an abortionist asking you for sex before performing an abortion.
It is, and I think people forget how common those kinds of experiences were.
Now, initially, the women in this underground network referred women to underground abortionists. How did they find the abortionists and screen them?
Well, to your first question, the person who organized the group had been referring women on an ad hoc basis, and she had gathered a few names of doctors that she referred to. So they inherited that list from her. They also got names from women they knew who had illegal abortions. One name came from a doctor's receptionist. So from a variety of different sort of word-of-mouth ways, they collected a list and then contacted these doctors and talked with them and found out what they could.
Now, the women in Jane were in this for a larger cause, so that women could have control of their bodies and their reproductive lives. What were the abortionists in it for?
The abortionists primarily were in it for money. There were one or two doctors who were motivated by the suffering they saw in women patients. But the majority of the illegal practitioners were in it to make money.
Now, the Women of Jane, the underground abortion network, had to keep the identity of the abortionists and the women secret. How did you keep those identities secret?
The identity of the doctors was kept secret because the contact with the doctor was through only one or two members of the group. And so they had the primary responsibility of dealing with those people.
Now, women were actually blindfolded during the procedure so that they wouldn't recognize the doctor again? Was that the reason why?
Right, right. So that if anything happened vis-a-vis the police, for instance, they would not be in a position where they would be able to identify and therefore forced to identify someone. So it was for his protection as well as, in a way, their protection. So, I mean, it was impossible for them to say who it was because they couldn't see him. But they were with the one person we developed a very close working relationship with. They were only blindfolded at the point at which he was in the room.
You know, blindfolds always symbolize a complete loss of control.
Right.
And you feel so out of control when any procedure is being performed on your body, but there's something particularly violating feeling about, you know, thinking of an abortion procedure. So how did the women feel about having to wear a blindfold at such an uncomfortable moment?
Well, first let me say there were some illegal abortionists who blindfolded women, who picked them up on street corners and blindfolded them as soon as they picked them up, put on sleeping masks and dark glasses in a car so they didn't even know where they were going to. So
that really was emphasizing really, loss of control there. Yeah.
Really frightening experience.
Yeah.
We dealt with it by talking to women and explaining what was going to happen. Before we were directly involved in the abortions, the doctor's nurse did that explaining, and they saw her. And she explained, this is for your protection as well as his. It's only while he's in the room. In a few cases where women really could not handle the blindfolds, then the nurse would hold, for instance, a pillow in front of someone's face. Not over their face, obviously, but in front of their face just to block out the view of the doctor. And my own experience in interviewing women who had abortions with us was that even though they were blindfolded, because of the rapport the doctor established through his conversation that he immediately started with women, they felt remarkably comfortable. And they even noted to me that here they were blindfolded and they were feeling more comfortable than they'd felt in any other medical procedure they'd been through.
Now, because everybody's identity, the doctors, the women, had to be kept secret from each other because this was all very illegal, what kind of recourse did you have if something went badly in terms of the procedure? You couldn't exactly sue the doctor. The doctor was doing it illegally. You were doing it illegally.
That's right. There was no question of anybody suing anybody. What we did was we developed a high degree of trust with the women who came to us. I mean, they were entrusting us with their lives. And we, on the other hand, were also entrusting them with our freedom, almost our lives. We had to really be careful about who we worked with so that they were responsible people, because no matter how careful you are, no matter how competent you are, no matter how many degrees you have after your name, things can go wrong in a medical procedure. So we had to work with people who we could locate for follow-up, who we could contact if there was a problem, and we used hospitals and a doctor network we established for emergencies or where problems arose after an abortion.
Say after an abortion in the days when it was illegal and you were part of this underground network, a woman had an infection and needed to go to the hospital. Well, the hospital would probably realize that it was the after effects of an illegal abortion. What would the hospital do? Would they interrogate the woman and try to find out who was behind this illegal procedure?
That was very common, and it entirely depended on the hospital and the personnel who were working that day. But very commonly, women were threatened with police or threatened with no care, you know, told that we won't take care of you unless you tell us who did this to you. So we had to prepare women, and we did this in counseling sessions before the abortion, for what might go wrong and what they could expect if they had to go to a hospital.
What would you tell them?
We would say, these are the things that can happen. You may be threatened with the police. You may be, the hospital personnel may say to you, we're not going to treat you unless you talk. They have an obligation to treat you, so, you know, try to stay strong. You tell them what happened. Just tell them that you don't know where you were or who did it. I mean, one thing we had working for us is there was an assumption about women that women were kind of ignorant. And so if a woman played dumb, it often got bought.
So you played out the stereotype, too.
That's right. Use the stereotype to your own benefit.
You're right. You couldn't exactly take out an ad in newspapers and magazines to advertise this underground abortion referral service. How did women find out about Jane?
Women found out in a variety of ways. The original group had put together a small pamphlet, and that was passed around at women's groups and political groups and found its way into the hands of a number of doctors. In the early days, many of our referrals came from doctors. In fact, there's a story that I tell in the book about one of the members who found out she was pregnant, went to her doctor, and it was shortly after New York legalized abortion, and she said to him, I think I'll have an abortion. I think I'll go to New York. And he said, well, you don't have to do that. There's people right here in Chicago who can do this for you. See my receptionist if you're interested. And so she did. And the name and phone number was our name and phone number. So that a lot of referrals came from medical people. There was also a lot of word of mouth, so that we wound up seeing a number of women who came from the same community because they heard about it from a neighbor. Relatives, cousins, any way that people find things out that you can't find out by looking in the yellow pages, people found out. And one of the main ways that women found out about Jane was they called the Women's Liberation Union. We were very fortunate in Chicago in that the women's liberation groups were organized in an umbrella group called the Chicago Women's Liberation Union. And they gave out referrals for all sorts of things, including Jane.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Laura Kaplan, and she's written a new book called The Story of Jane, and it's about an underground feminist abortion network referral service, and eventually the women in this group provided the abortions themselves. And Laura was a member of this group for about a year and a half. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Laura Kaplan, the author of the new book, The Story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service. The service operated in the 70s before abortion was legalized in 1973. When Jane started, the women referred women who needed abortions to abortionists. But eventually, the women of Jane decided they wanted to just stick with one doctor, a doctor who'd basically be working for them, so that the consistency and reliability would be more assured. There'd be less risk. There'd be less uncertainty. The doctor went by, in your book, uses the pseudonym of Nick. Why was he so good for Jane?
The women who started Jane from the beginning realized that what was critical was for them to gain control over the doctors. That way they would assure good care of the women, competent abortions, and they would have some control over the exorbitant prices that these doctors tended to charge. They looked for someone with whom they could negotiate and set up some kind of system where they could gain control. And they did, in fact, find one person who was willing to meet with them and talk with them. At that point, they thought they were meeting with the middleman, a man named Nick, and he was willing to negotiate with them.
It turned out, after working with him for a while, the women found out he wasn't really a doctor.
Well, first they found out that he wasn't a middleman, that he, in fact, was the person performing the abortions. And then they found out that, indeed, he wasn't a doctor. But by then, they had been working with him for over a year.
And they really liked him.
They liked him. He was responsible. He was extremely competent. The feedback they got from women who had post-abortion checkups was that the abortions were excellent. They had no problems. That in itself, I think, is kind of a mind-altering experience. I'm sure it will be for people who read the story. I know it was for women in the group. It really forced everyone to reassess the situation. You assume competence means professional credentials. And what they discovered is that competence doesn't always mean medical credentials.
Now, did this revelation that Nick wasn't really a doctor help inspire the women of Jane to learn to do abortions themselves?
Well, certainly at the meeting where this information was revealed to the entire group, there was an explosion of feeling. Some women felt that they had been lied to and they had been lying to women, and that our prime directive, if you will, was never lie to women. And so here they had been lying to women, and they felt terrible about it. Other women felt that finding out that he wasn't a doctor made us no different from any back alley abortion, and they could no longer work with the group. For other women, it was a revelation and kind of mind-expanding information. And in fact, one of the women did say at that meeting, well, if he can do it and he's not a doctor, then we can do it too. What she didn't know at that point was that one of the women had already taken that step. One of the women he was extremely close with was already learning how to do the abortions.
So tell us more about how the women of Jane started to provide the abortions themselves.
I think one thing to keep in mind is that no one from the original days of Jane, of the service, as we referred to ourselves, had any thought that they would be performing abortions. They thought what anybody else would think, that this was a highly skilled medical task requiring years of study. It had not entered their minds that they would be the ones performing abortions. But through a series of fortuitous incidents, they wound up in a position where they were attending abortions, assisting our abortionist, this man Nick, holding women's hands, filling syringes, inserting specula, and some of the very minor medical tasks associated with an abortion, and watching many, many, many abortions. And at that point, it started to dawn on a couple of women that we could do this and we could charge a whole lot less than what he's charging. And he also was, because of his developing relationship with the several women in the group, he was interested in sharing some of his skill, interested up to a point, I think. It was always kind of a push-pull thing with him. Yes, I want to do this. No, I don't want to do this. So initially, he encouraged one of the women to start doing more of the medical skills, and then at some point, she started pushing to learn more and more.
You know, you were saying before the women started doing the abortions themselves, they assumed that this was a highly skilled medical task that required years of study. Well, isn't it?
Well, in fact, an abortion is a fairly simple... We were doing dilation and curettage abortions, and it is a very fairly simple medical technique. It's not so simple that, you know, someone without any training could do it, but it's not extremely complex. It does require a certain amount of skill because you can't see what you're doing. The instruments are inside the uterus, but you can't see inside the uterus, so you have to do it by feel. So it requires a lot of training. And that the women in the group got by apprenticing with first Nick and then with the women who were trained in the group. So it was a long apprenticeship period that women who did abortions went through.
Did you have any parameters at Jane at how pregnant a woman would be before you'd say, it's too late, we won't do an abortion?
Well, this was a constant source of discussion in the group that we never could resolve. Should we set a limit? First of all, you have to understand it was a very different circumstance, so that sometimes women spent months trying to find the name and phone number of someone who could do an abortion, and by then they were, you know, 4 months pregnant or even more. It was not their fault. They had been looking for 3-4 months to find someone that they could trust. Our feeling was that we were the instruments of women's will, and so we did what she wanted us to do. The other side of that argument was that, of course, we're more than the instruments of women's will. We are actors in this, and we have a right to and a responsibility to make some decisions about, you know, how late is too late to get an abortion. And so this was a tension that was always in the group and wound up being resolved individually by the individual practitioners on a particular workday. The other piece of this is that it's not so easy to tell exactly how pregnant somebody is, so that was another sort of piece thrown into the pot of making this kind of decision. But this was a really rough one for us because our focus was that we were there to do what women needed. Yet, we did have a responsibility. All I can say is that this was never resolved.
Now, what was the track record of the women in Jane?
Our track record, as far as we know, now I have to say this quite honestly, Terry, we kept no records, and so we had, except for a short period near the end, we had no official follow-up method so that we knew exactly what happened to women. But there was a period towards the end when we did connect with a gynecologist in Chicago who agreed to see women in the group after their abortions for post-abortion checkups. And from the checkups he did, the follow-up he did with women, what we discovered was that our problem rate for DNC abortions was about the same as it was for New York City, which had legalized abortions in the summer of 1970.
Now, one woman died after an abortion. Was that while the women of Jane were providing the abortions themselves?
That was in sort of an interim period where a number of different people, several different men and several women in the group, were all doing abortions. So there were a number of different people.
That must have been quite a crisis for everybody.
It was. I mean, one thing that I want to make very clear is that this was a woman who came to us severely infected from attempts to abort herself or from, we're not even sure. We think she went to somebody else. We don't know exactly. She did admit that she had tried other methods to abort, and she came to us severely infected, and we told her, you know, there's nothing we can do for you. You have to get to a hospital. And unfortunately, she waited. And by the time she went to a hospital, her infection had spread past the point where there was really anything that could be done. For the group, this was devastating. I mean, we had started this organization to prevent this kind of thing from happening. And here it had happened, so to speak, on our watch. Even though we hadn't done it to her, she had passed through our hands and she had died. And it was devastating for the women in the group.
Laura Kaplan is the author of The Story of Jane. She worked with the Underground Feminist Abortion Service. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Over the years, we've been following the career of rock instrumentalist, composer, and producer Ben Vaughan. He's now composing for film and TV. Coming up, we check in with him and hear the theme he wrote for the new sitcom, Third Rock from the Sun. And we continue our interview with Laura Kaplan about the underground feminist abortion network that was known as Jane. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Laura Kaplan. Her new book, The Story of Jane, is about the underground feminist abortion service known as Jane that helped 11,000 women get abortions during the last 4 years before abortion was legalized in 1973. Kaplan was a member during the last year and a half of the group's existence. The abortions were performed in members' apartments and in other apartments rented for that purpose. Were women ever arrested?
Yes. In May of 1972, seven women in the group were arrested in a raid on an apartment we rented in Chicago.
What were the women charged with, and did they spend any time in jail? Were they found guilty?
The women were charged with both abortion and conspiracy to commit abortion. They were arrested, kept in jail overnight, bailed out the next day. And then eventually the case after Roe v. Wade, this was in May of 72, Roe v. Wade was decided in January of 73, and I believe it was in March the case was then thrown out of court. So the charges were dismissed and the records expunged.
Where were you the day that the Supreme Court legalized abortion?
I believe I was assisting at illegal abortions. That day. I mean, that's my recollection when someone came in the room and announced the Roe v. Wade decision. I was sitting next to a woman and holding her hand and talking to her during her abortion.
So what was the reaction of that you had and that the other woman at Jane had? Because this was a victory for you. On the other hand, it was making your work obsolete.
Right. Well, I think we were, by that time, we were very tired and exhausted. And I can't really describe to you the incredible amount of work each of us did and the responsibility we took, we were willing to take for other women's lives. I slept with a phone in my bed in case somebody called or in the middle of the night with a problem. There were evenings where a woman would call me every half hour. Because she was having cramps or something was happening she wasn't sure of, and I would try to talk her through it or try to figure it out, but I would be up all night with her trying to find women after their abortion. Sometimes women just disappeared and didn't want to talk to us to make sure they were okay. So we were under an incredible amount of pressure and stress. So our overwhelming feeling was one of relief because we don't have to do this anymore. We don't have to risk our own freedom. We don't have to risk women's lives. We don't have to put ourselves out on the line like this anymore. So I think our overwhelming feeling was one of relief. On the other hand, we saw what we were doing as a challenge to the way medicine had been practiced in a much greater scope than just about abortion and women being able to obtain abortions. Our own experience with the medical establishment for many of us had not been too happy. We hadn't felt respected. We hadn't felt that we had been listened to. We had felt like objects of medical care. In our own practice, we reversed that so that women really felt in control. They felt that what was happening was really about them. And they saw the experience, and women told me this, that I interviewed for the book, as a growing and learning experience that changed the way they looked at themselves and the way they looked at medical care in general. So we were looking at, by that point, we were seeing what we were doing in a much larger context. And the Roe v. Wade decision, because it was written very clearly in terms of doctors' rights, undercut those efforts. And it wasn't, let me say this, it wasn't just us. There was the women's self-help movement in California, which was doing a lot to educate women and for women to take control of their own health care. There were women's health clinics starting, run by lay women, again, all with the idea that we educate ourselves so that we can have some control over our own health care, so we aren't sort of helpless and vulnerable to whatever the medical establishment wants to tell us.
Well, tell me more about how you think the legalization of abortion ended up undercutting some of the efforts of the women's health movement.
Because there was a movement taking place that continued into the 70s that was about women taking power over their own health care, learning about their own bodies, learning about medicine. You know, basics of medicine. We're not talking about anything very complicated here. Demanding information, demanding to be treated as partners. What the Roe v. Wade decision did was it validated the medical profession in women's eyes again, because it gave doctors the power over abortion once again. The decision says it's a doctor's decision, if you read the decision, Roe v. Wade decision. And so in that way, there was this groundswell happening, and in terms of abortion, it undercut it. Now, what I want to say is the women's health movement went on through the 70s, and in fact, there were still, in many cities, women's health clinics operating with that same focus on education and empowerment.
So, Laura, when abortion was legalized and Jane disbanded, did you stay in the women's health movement?
Yes, I did. In fact, a number of the people from Jane, as well as a lot of other women in the city of Chicago, organized a women's health center called the Emma Goldman Women's Health Center in Chicago, and provided well woman health care, which included pregnancy tests, pap smears, which Nick had taught us to do, teaching women to do breast self-exams. We learned to fit diaphragms. We learned to diagnose simple vaginal infections and treat them, you know, so just very basic well woman's health care. We did a lot of education in the clinic, and sometimes we did, for instance, if there were several women who had vaginal infections, well, let's say there were several women who wanted diaphragms, we would ask them if they would want to do it as a group. So we'd do a group diaphragm fitting where everyone would get to fit each other's diaphragm so that each woman would learn how a diaphragm is fitted. So again, it was part of the demystification of the medical process and this growing sense of women's power over their own bodies and their own health care.
In the days when you were counseling women and sleeping with a phone in your bed in case you got phone calls in the middle of the night, did you ever feel like you were in over your head, that a woman could call about a bad infection and you could maybe do on the phone hand-holding, but you weren't a doctor? How much medical advice could you give her?
Well, we were very clear about what we didn't know. And in a case like that, I would say to the woman, get yourself to an emergency room right now. Do not wait. Call a cab. Get, you know, your husband to drive you, your next-door neighbor to drive you, immediately go to an emergency room so that, so that's how I personally, and I think most of the people in the group, dealt with those kinds of, anything that seemed out of our hands. But of course, we were a little bit out of our depth, especially in the later days of Jane. I have to say this. Once the women in the group took control of the entire abortion process, we lowered the price to what a woman could afford, and the most we charged was $100. And we rapidly became a service for poor women and women with no resources. And as poorer and poorer women came to us, they were, what we saw was women who were less and less healthy, had more complicated medical problems. And then, in fact, for the people who were doing the abortions specifically, it got very scary because we did feel we were over our heads. It's one thing to do an abortion on a 20-year-old woman who's in perfect health and another to do an abortion on a 38-year-old woman who's had 12 pregnancies, has high blood pressure, maybe seriously overweight, all kinds of problems, some of which the women who came to us didn't even know about, so they couldn't tell us about it in advance. So then it did get very frightening, which is why we were so relieved when Roe v. Wade happened. I have to say, I think we were extremely lucky that some great force was smiling on us because something really terrible could have happened.
Laura Kaplan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Laura Kaplan is the author of the new book, The Story of Jane, The Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service. This is Fresh Air. Over the years, we've been keeping up with the career of Ben Vaughan, a rock songwriter, instrumentalist, and producer whose music we quite like. He produced singer Arthur Alexander's last record and led the band that backed Alexander in a live Fresh Air concert shortly before Alexander's death in 1993. The Ben Vaughan Combo performed a rock concert of Christmas songs on our show a couple of years ago. Vaughan also joined us after the release of his CD Mono, an album featuring covers of obscure rock songs recorded in mono in his basement studio. Until a year ago, Vaughan lived in New Jersey, across the bridge from Philadelphia. He's been a local favorite for years. 1 year ago, he moved to L.A., where he's been writing music for film and TV. He composed the theme for the new sitcom Third Rock from the Sun, which premieres tonight on NBC. It's about four aliens who are visiting Earth on a mission to sample life on the planet. Here's Ben's theme. Ben Vaughan, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's great to be back.
When you started working on this new TV show, what did they tell you they wanted for the theme?
Well, actually, what they told me they wanted was classic rock and roll as if played by aliens, which is why they called me, I think.
So
what,
what
I do.
What did that mean to you?
It meant I just keep doing my thing, I guess. They really pretty much gave me full rein to be as weird as I want, as long as it was really fun, you know. It's funny because they were looking for a composer for a while, and everyone they tried out was, you know, I don't know if you're that familiar with what's going on in television composing now, but there's a lot of, you know, other TV music is, a lot of it's really lame. I mean, it sounds like Fern Bar jazz, you know, with saxophone or fake New Orleans stuff or that what I call lifestyle supplement blues, you know, blues with no danger, you know, blues uh-huh. you can put on your coffee table and admire, you know, and they had interviewed a lot of composers, and they weren't satisfied, and then they hooked on to me, and they realized that what I was doing was really matched the show.
Now, how had they heard of you?
Well, the way they heard of me, I was on, I was being interviewed on the radio in Los Angeles, and the president of Carsey Werner, which is the production company that does the show, they also do Roseanne and Grace Under Fire. And she was on her way to work with the idea of looking for a composer on her mind, and she heard me being interviewed and heard some excerpts from my instrumental stylings record and thought that I was the guy. And so she sought me out.
Now, it seems almost like a slightly cheerier, more, like more upbeat version of some of the, slightly less dark than some of the stuff you've been writing.
Well, yeah, I go the gamut, you know, from, I do some real cheery stuff, and I also really like dark, moody pieces. Especially, I really like film music. Ennio Morricone and Nino Rota are my two favorite guys. And, you know, I'm a fan of Burt Bacharach. But I also like, you know, just Chuck Berry. And the theme actually has a lot of Chuck Berry or Carl Perkins kind of feel. It's more of a rockabilly theme than it is a surf theme. But there is some surf motifs, like there's something that sounds like Pipeline in there. And there's but there's also a section in the middle where everything goes out of key for, you know, about 8 beats, and that's my signature right there. To make sure. that's so you there's no question that I did the theme.
Now, when you wrote the theme for this TV show, Third Rock from the Sun, how many people had to listen and approve it or make suggestions before it was agreed on?
Well, there was three people I was working with: Karen Mandelbach, who is the president, Carsey Werner, and also Bonnie and Terry Turner, who are the creators and head writers of the show and producers of the show. And we sat around together, and we listened to a bunch of records together. We listened to some Carl Perkins and some surf music and a bunch of things on a boombox in an office. And we agreed on what were the cool things that should be incorporated. And then I just went home and smashed them all together in under 30 seconds.
Was it odd for you to have a client to please as opposed to just doing stuff in your room for yourself?
Yeah, it's real interesting. I really like it because I was, you know, all through the years, I only wrote for myself and never really cared too much about whether anybody liked it. I was only trying to please myself. And it's really, really interesting to write on spec and maintain your integrity. It's really exciting. I really like it. I really like deadlines.
Now, I'd like to give our listeners a sense of some of your other instrumental music. I thought I'd play something from your album Instrumental Stylings. This is called Infermo, and this is kind of a little spaghetti westernish. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what it is. And then some.
No, were you listening to a lot of Ennio Morricone when you wrote this?
I've always been, you know, I've always been collecting his records, and now there's a, you know, some stuff available on CD, but I've always had his albums of every one of his soundtracks that I could find.
Right,
through
and
the years.
He, of course, did Good, Bad, and the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, and then the American Once Upon a Time in the West.
Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about him is the cheap lead guitar that's like really tinny, trebly lead guitar that's on top of some pretty lush arrangements. I really enjoy his stuff a lot.
Okay, so this is Infermo, Ben Vaughan from his album Instrumental Stylings. And you're playing all the parts on this?
Yeah, I'm playing all the instruments.
Okay. Ben Vaughan playing all the instruments on a composition he wrote, featured on his album Instrumental Stylings.
That was me on finger cymbals.
And you can also hear his music on TV now. He wrote the theme for the new TV show Third Rock from the Sun. Now, I know you also like Nino Rota. a lot. And there's a track on this CD that's, I think, very, very much an homage to Nino Rota, and it's called Al Dante.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me what you were picking up on Nino Rota's music when writing this. And he did a lot of music for Fellini movies.
Nino Rota is a phenomenal composer, and he's also a composer that, you know, an idiot from the rock and roll field like myself can relate to. His theme to Eight and a Half is Eight and a Half, and also La Dolce Vita are just they're great. And he's Al Dente is also inspired by the theme from A Man and a Woman by Francis Lai. I don't know if you remember that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1966. That was the first foreign film I remember existing when I was a kid, because that was a big deal and that music was around everywhere.
Good. Well, let's hear it. This is Ben Vorn's, how do you say it, Al Dente?
Al Dente, yes.
Okay. That's Al Dante from Ben Vorn's album Instrumental Stylings. Now, Ben, I figure after writing music like this, you were really prepared to start writing movie scores. This sounds like it ought to be a movie score.
Yeah, well, I've been writing this kind of stuff forever. You know, when I was on a record label, which I won't mention, many years ago, I think it was in 1988, I approached them about doing an instrumental record that in my mind would sound exactly like the one I didn't put out until 95. And they told me I was crazy and that, it was stupid and I should just stick to rock and roll and try to, you know, pound that home. And I laid off the idea of releasing anything like this, but I started to record what's on this record, I think probably as early as 89. And I've always been recording. It's all home recording, so there was no clock running or studio bills to pay. So I would work on ideas when I got them. And, I've been doing this. This has been the sound in my mind probably my whole life, but also, I was actually physically recording stuff for a long time before it came out.
Now, did you play all the parts on these records because you didn't have friends who were also interested in that kind of sound?
It's because I don't have any friends. If you listen to my records, you know why. No, actually, it's easier for me to kind of, I'm composing as I'm recording, so it's very difficult when I have other musicians waiting for me to give them direction. A lot of times I can't verbalize what that direction may be, so I'm always kind of working things out, and I record alone. I really enjoy it. It's a really peaceful process. It really puts me in a place that is very calm and very rewarding, and it's just there's no explaining needed. I'm just working, and I get into a rhythm.
My guest is Ben Vorn. His latest solo CD is called Instrumental Stylings. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with rock composer and musician Ben Vaughn. His credits include the theme for the new NBC sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. Now, I know there's a project you're working on that's going to be a CD of music that you recorded in your car?
That is correct. That's the last thing I did before I left New Jersey. And New Jersey, growing up in South Jersey, is a strange experience. It's the kind of environment that inspires one to go out and record an album in their car, in their driveway. It's I got the idea. I was working in a studio producing some demos for someone, and we were having trouble getting a good sound on some conga drums. And no matter where we placed the guy and mic'd them and padded things down and hung blankets, it just sounded horrible. And as a joke, I said, you know, we ought to record him in my car. It'd probably sound even better in my car. And I, like, you know, we all laughed and everything, but a light went off in my head, and I was thinking, hey, has anyone ever done that? Recorded an entire album in their car? So I kind of dared myself. And at the time, I was looking for something to do that was completely stupid, but required a lot of time. I just felt like I needed a really dumb challenge, you know, and that was it. I did it, and it's coming out soon.
So how did it sound?
Oh, it sounds great. It's my best record yet, actually. I think the restrictions of recording in my car really, I rose to the occasion, you know. I try to do one take on everything because it's kind of claustrophobic in there when you're you know, playing guitar and engineering and running a tape recorder at the same time, you know. It got pretty claustrophobic in there.
Gee, now what did you like about the acoustics of your car?
Well, you know, my radio always sounded good in there when I listened to it. I figured that was a good sign, you know. And, you know, great rock and roll. So many great rock and roll songs I mean, the car and rock and roll are always related. A song like Maybelline by Chuck Berry is about a car. You know, some of the greatest songs are about cars. Even Don't Worry Baby by the Beach Boys is about a car race. And I have heard my favorite songs for the first time while in a car, and it's just, to me, it's like the same thing, you know. And I figured if I moved the music into the car, it wouldn't be that weird of an idea.
So what kind of car was it?
A 1965 Rambler American.
Boy, you're lucky the car was running, let alone serving as a recording studio.
That's true.
Are you a car guy? I mean, do you know how to fix cars? How did you keep it on the road for so long?
Well, I know how to fix cars well enough. I mean, I've never been stranded without being able to get myself home. But the Rambler is the only car I've ever owned. I've had five, and ever since I got out of high school. I'm on my fifth Rambler now. I have one on the East Coast, which is the one I recorded the record on, and I have a 64 that I'm driving out here that I drove across the country.
You're in such a different world now than the world you were in just over a year ago when you were still in New Jersey.
I'm hanging with Lithgow, you know.
But, you know, you were in addition to producing records and doing your own stuff, you were playing in, like, rock clubs, doing that whole scene for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to get out, too. It was like, it was a thing of, you know, as you get older in the rock and roll business, you really have to think about getting off stage and moving into the front office somehow, you know, where the way you look isn't as important anymore, you know, because rock and roll, really, you got to look pretty young. And there comes a point where nobody looks young anymore. And it's sad when people are still out there slugging it out on stage, you know, posing as young people. And I wanted to make sure that didn't happen to me. I started looking into songwriting and producing, and film scoring has always been something I've wanted to do. And finally, now I'm into it.
Describe that feeling for me of feeling like you're a little too old to be playing a certain rock club.
Describe it. I think I feel it more when I'm watching other people who are too old and are still doing it. I think I'm not exactly bailing out yet, but I'm making sure that it isn't what I have to do for money, you know, get on stage. Because the money you make on stage is here and gone. And songwriting and producing and scoring, there's back-end money. And there's no pension for people like me, you know, totally independent people that don't work for a company. You know, you don't get health benefits and all that. And you have to really figure out exactly how you can keep working on stuff that excites you and keeps you creative, but not go broke and be, you know, living in a flop house.
Ben Vaughn wrote the theme for the new sitcom Third Rock from the Sun, which premieres tonight on NBC. His latest solo CD is called Instrumental Stylings, and he has a new CD in collaboration with Kim Fowley called Kings of Saturday Night. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.